This is side B of session number 61, recorded on March 24, 2008. Now, we need to look at the gravity's rainbow. What's interesting is that we have on record Thomas Pynchon, the author of Gravity's Rainbow, and he's writing this in the late 60s, comes out in 1973. He's got the LaRouche conspiracy stuff in there, going back to I.G. Farben in Germany in the 20s.
But he doesn't mention LaRouche.
No, no, no. I mean, he's got the LaRouche quadrant themes, the holopathic radio themes.
Mm-hmm.
He's got the top-down in there, focusing around Germany in the 20s and 30s, and how they overlap with American wealthy people. And then he has a section that in a letter he writes to a PhD student that was based on McLuhan stuff when he does the scenes in Africa. So he's got a bit of McLuhan in him, and the scholar David Seed published that stuff back in 88. He's a British English scholar. And then you have the UFOs, the goblins, the elves, the fantasy world, whatever you want to call it. That is part of Gravity's Rainbow. So he's got the Thompson world in there, all right?
Mm-hmm.
And he mixes them all up. So it's appropriate that knowledge be in the Thompson Quadrant, because like Thompson, he builds on LaRouche, refers to the LaRouche world and to the McLuhan world, and then brings in the occult world or the universal world.
Mm-hmm.
So that's why Gravity's Rainbow fits there.
Is that book a straight read, or is it kind of like Finnegan's Wake?
As a straight read? What'd you say?
Yeah, is it, linear? I heard that the book was kind of, non-linear.
Well, it's written with genius, and Tim Leary called it the Finnegan's Wake of American literature.
Right.
So most people find it a dense, difficult read. It's not, as extreme as Finnegan's Wake. It's not a collage of languages, but it's the style might be a little discontinuous for the average reader back in 73.
Mm-hmm.
It made a big impact at the time. So,
why do you think that book was so important to Tim Leary? He said it was his Bible while he was in prison.
Well, it's an encyclopedia of American and European culture and science and the beginning of the information age. And so Leary was into the LaRouche quadrant themes, the McLuhan themes, and the universal government themes. So it's all right there for him to study.
Pynchon was a recluse, wasn't he?
Yes, he's never allowed any real publicity about himself.
Yeah. I remember one time you mentioned to somebody you knew where he lived or something.
Yeah, I know where he lives in Manhattan. But before, or when he lived in New Jersey, whenever that was, the early 90s, or if he still has a place over there, I know that he went around to all the libraries and found any early published books of his with his photo on it, and cut out the photo.
Wow.
There's a standard high school or college yearbook photo that the publicist used back in the early days, in the early 60s.
Uh-huh.
So he's really trying to be a member of Unknowns Anonymous.
Yeah.
Okay, so that
so,
is...
So he's also similar to Thompson in that way. Thompson doesn't like to be interviewed, right?
Right. They're kind of paranoid about media.
Did Thompson ever comment on Pynchon or Gravity's Rainbow?
Yes, yeah. Can't recall right now, but he certainly read it. What was it? Like, electric Kool-Aid acid test is about people who aren't afraid of the media. They want to use the media. The Mary pranksters.
Oh, yeah.
So that's more aligned with the McLuhan quadrant.
But they want to put on the media. It's not that they want to become like a, Britney Spears, with the media focusing on them as some kind of superstar.
Yeah, they wanted to put it on.
Yeah.
It's kind of a yippie sensibility.
Yeah.
So we've done Gravity's Rainbow, Hysteria, Unisex.
What did we do, Hysteria?
Yeah, that was the paranoia about the ecology collapsing. The world was getting... A big influence on Thompson was the Club of Rome's report called Limits to Growth, where they used computer inventory and decided that the world was going into a real dark age with really devastating ecological damage. And that came out in 71, I think. And Thompson refers to that book, and McLuhan, when he met with the Club of Rome people, he called them the Club of Ruin and made fun of them. Mm-hmm. He says, you guys are just helping the media swill by putting out bad news, which is good news for people, because good news makes people feel they survived. Remember that whole thing I told you about?
Mm-hmm.
So the hysteria is the ecological movement, the Earth Day movement, the global warming idea. Now, you know, a lot of people think that's a fact, right? And LaRouche has always put that down, said it's not a fact. But I think the majority of people are concerned about global warming and think the ecology has been damaged, depending on where you're coming from, whether you consider it hysterical or not. But it is certainly regarded as a hysterical reaction to industrialism by a lot of people. Right? So
right.
That's why it's hysterical. Just as LaRouche is considered paranoid by a lot of people. And McLuhan is considered schizophrenic by a lot of people.
Mm-hmm.
Now, but that's just in relation to McLuhan, LaRouche, and Thompson. The hysteria also relates to the computer satellite environment itself, right?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, computerization back then was fearful to people. Smacked of Orwellian automated despair.
Right. Well, how would you distinguish hysteria from paranoia or schizophrenia?
The thing I just said about automated despair, mm-hmm. that was one of McLuhan's themes, that people who were afraid that automation would create an even more powerful centralized Big Brother situation did not understand that the essence of computerization was decentralization. And that prediction was borne out by the digital revolution of the last 15 years.
Yeah, that's when we were getting the movies like that movie...
Soylent Green.
Soylent Green and... remember the name, we mentioned it once a long time ago, but where West
Solaris?
Westland?
Yeah, Solaris.
Solaris, yeah. And then there was the one where, you know, human beings are becoming automated slaves. And it was...
Blade Runner?
No, this was almost a comedy. I don't remember the name of it. I thought it was
called Woody Allen's Sleeper.
It was called Westlands or Western
Westworld.
Westworld, yeah.
Yeah, they were robotoid killers or something.
Yeah.
Yeah, those kind of movies were coming out in that early 70s period.
So you would lump that in with hysteria.
Yeah. Hysteria is probably different from paranoia. Paranoia is a strategy state of mind. You see a problem and you're frightened by it, but you're cool enough to create an attempt to get rid of it or counter it.
Yeah.
Hysteria is just kind of like almost panic.
It's more of an emotional impulse as opposed to the paranoia, which is more of a mental game.
Yeah, you lose control.
Yeah.
You're frightened and at your wit's end. You've got the composure to organize a paranoid response.
But in that sense, it becomes close to panic, but not quite as intense.
Right. Panic might be, well, they're both group phenomenon, but it's in the column indicating psychological states. So panic would be a combination of paranoia, schizophrenia, and hysteria. Panic might be, okay, I've calmed down, now I got to do something about it. But you might make some mistakes because you didn't have time to work out a clever paranoid response.
Yeah.
Or a response to perceived paranoia.
Panic is probably closest to fight or flight.
Yeah. So, now we did Atlantean, Tokyo, hard hats. What happened in that period, 67 to 72, the hard hats surfaced around 1970, and they attack the demonstrators, the yippies, the hippies, and that, and the new left. actually, they're sort of like the average citizen, continuing the theme of the Democratic Convention in Chicago, where the police supposedly had a riot and beat up the citizens and journalists and everybody. So the hard hats institutionalized that, probably with mafia backing, because a lot of them were construction workers, right?
Mm-hmm.
So the movie Joe, J-O-E, if you haven't seen that, see that sometime. That came out in this period, 71, 72. That it crystallizes the rise of the hard hat meme and the vengeance on the 60s counterculture.
Mm-hmm.
So,
then we got, tell me a little about T.S. Eliot's literary output.
Well, he was born in St. Louis, grew up in St. Louis. That's in Missouri, right?
Yep.
And went to Harvard, and then he went to England and imagined himself a poet or maybe a philosopher. He took a philosophy course at Oxford or Cambridge or some university in England, and Bradley was the philosopher he was influenced by, but he decided to become a poet in the mid-teens, somewhere's in there. Maybe he was writing before that, but he presented himself to Ezra Pound and Wyndham Lewis in late 1914, early 1915. I think he was working in a bank at that time. He was a bank clerk. And then shortly after that, he married a woman, Valerie, somebody who becomes Valerie Elliott, and she turns out to be hysterical and has a nervous breakdown. Apparently that was after Bertrand Russell had an affair with her or weaseled his way in, and because I think they stayed in his domicile or something like that. And so she had a breakdown, so Elliot had to deal with that for like 30 years. And so on the personal level, his depressed state comes out of in the poem, the famous 1922 poem, The Wasteland, which revolutionized modern poetics.
Yeah.
And it was edited by Ezra Pound. He'd done a poem in 1916 about called the Love Song of J. Alfred Prufrock. I think that had a bit of an impact. But The Wasteland had a huge impact.
When does he do The Wasteland?
It came out in 1922, same year as Ulysses.
Mm.
James Joyce's Ulysses. So he became famous.
That was sort of a comment on the media wiping out our sensibilities or something, wasn't it?
Yeah, people probably didn't see that. They didn't see media at that time. It was an invisible environment or electric media. So some people might have thought it was the desolation or the effect of World War One. Others might have thought, if they knew about him, it was his personal life with his wife. But it turns out that the revolutionary part is he was talking about the effect of the telephone and modern media dynamics.
Do you see it as being fatalistic?
Did he see it that way?
Well, do you, The Wasteland?
Oh, I never read it. No, I would say it's pretty pretty depressing, but I don't see it as, once I get over the initial emotional in response to it, I start analyzing it. It's more of a map of present tensions and pressures caused by the new media on the literate sensibility.
Yeah. But that specific poem, The Wasteland, doesn't particularly relate to William Irwin Thompson's commentaries.
Yeah? You asking me if it does?
Yeah.
No, it's the same sensibility. William Irwin Thompson thinks we're moving into a dark age, a new dark age. He desponded and left MIT and academia. He didn't like the way the Vietnam War was managed or the way the technocrats were running the world. So he dropped out and went back to nature.
Mm-hmm.
Now, Eliot didn't do that completely, unless Eliot meant that, but you couldn't do it back then.
Yeah.
The Wasteland is organized around the alchemical elements of fire, earth, air, and water. It has a five-part structure that McLuhan discovered was the tradition of rhetoric, the five parts of rhetoric.
Mm-hmm.
Let's see. You know, Eliot and Joyce and Pound were classical poets.
Mm-hmm.
They embedded ancient modalities like the five parts of rhetoric in their poetic structure.
Mm-hmm.
I think McLuhan would call it a newspaper epic, or a combination of a book and newspaper poem.
Mm-hmm.
McLuhan student Joe Keough showed how the telephone was an important medium in the play or in the poem.
Mm-hmm.
So then Eliot later converted to the Anglican faith. He had all kinds of crises of faith, or crises all the way through. And then he became a playwright in the late 40s and actually became really famous on Broadway for a couple plays he did. And he developed, the plays would be written as poetry. So the actors would recite kind of a poetic style
mm-hmm.
when they're performing in a theater.
Mm-hmm.
So anyways, that's Eliot. Totally resonant with the 1918-1945 period.
Right. And,
so he's the archetype that Lewis, that Thompson. Oh, yeah, Eliot was very interested in, as I say, in Up the Orphic Andy, he was very interested in Asian, Oriental, and James Frazer, Golden Bough mythologies. He was encyclopedic like Joseph Campbell or Thompson.
Right.
And kind of a Gnostic, if you want to call Thompson a Gnostic.
Right.
McLuhan later rejected Eliot for being a Buddhist.
Oh, really?
Yeah, so what were you going to say?
Reading from Up the Orphic Ante, both Eliot and Thompson work in / with the institution of cathedrals and were obsessed with Paleolithic, Neolithic, and Oriental theologies.
Yeah, that's the Golden Bough stuff. What became popularized, replayed by Joseph Campbell, you know, in his books. They were working on that stuff back then. And you said, what was the phrase just before?
Paleolithic and Neolithic.
Oh, cathedrals. One of his plays was called Murder in the Cathedral.
Mm.
So, yeah.
What was the Paleolithic reference, Neolithic?
Well, like Thompson studying primitive societies, that was what the Golden Bough was about, early primitive religion, shamanism, and the early Corn King myths.
Oh, the Golden Bough is a book about that?
Yeah, it's one of the original anthropologies in the 19th century of encyclopedia of religions all around the world and rituals and pagan rituals, and he creates a pattern.
Right.
In a sense, Joseph Campbell replayed the Golden Bough.
Yeah.
But the author, James Frazer, he was what McLuhan called an armchair anthropologist. You know, he never went anywhere. He just read about all these things.
Right.
That the printing press... outpouring of knowledge in the 19th century allowed someone to read all the stuff and they could formulate theories.
The Yeats was primarily known as a poet, isn't that right?
Have you seen the movie Zeitgeist?
No.
Oh, you haven't seen that Zeitgeist. Well, a lot of people watch that on the internet. The kind of roots of Christianity and pagan Egyptian mythology and Roman mythology and all that.
Oh,
that kind,
I take that back. I did see it. Yeah, watched it on the internet.
That kind of information or pattern forming is what James Frazer pioneered with the Golden Bough.
Oh, okay.
So what did you ask?
Well, Yeats is primarily recognized as a poet, right?
Yeah.
Yeah. So he must have written a lot of poetry besides The Wasteland. And
you said Yeats, you mean Eliot.
I'm sorry, I was looking at the wrong
category.
Yeah,
he's regarded as a poet, yeah.
Yeah, okay.
Now what, is that what you were asking? Was there something else?
No, that pretty much wraps it up. He must have published volumes of to be known as a poet. You can't just have published one or two things. He must have been
he did volumes
of poetry.
He became the most famous poet in the world before 1960. He was the founder of modern poetry. I mean, Dylan mentions him in one of the songs. He says, I think Eliot and Pound are arguing in the ivory tower.
Right. Well, what distinguished Eliot from previous and post and later poets? Well, I mean, it wasn't
we could say surrealistic.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it was bizarre. It wasn't a normal kind of poem.
Yeah, he must have been, you know, breaking the traditional rules to have established himself as unique.
He was a revolutionary poet, and yet, you see, what happened is that he wrote this poem, and then Eliot edited out all the sort of old-fashioned stuff, the nostalgia referring to 19th century poetics or aesthetics, So it became more brutal and harsh and newer thanks to Pound. So Pound was considered the midwife of the wasteland, and Elliot was called the possum, meaning he pretended to be dead, like possums do. He pretended to be overridden by Pound, and there was probably a lot of reasons why he did that. I mean, Pound was more famous. Let Pound be identified with the poetry. I'm not sure about that stuff. But anyways, I know that he was considered the possum, and Pound was considered the midwife. So in a sense, it was a teamwork poem. It was a collective effort.
Yeah.
So that was a new kind of poetry.
Did he have did he and Pound know each other? Were they family?
Yeah. They met each other through Wyndham Lewis. Remember, Elliot is a vorticist. He's influenced by Wyndham Lewis and Pound.
Mm.
And in late 1914, after the first blast put out, Lewis meets Elliot first, or Pound meets Elliot, but they quickly introduce each other.
Mm-hmm. What's the vorticist movement all about?
That's the first people to look at media as a hidden electric media, the new media, the new technologies as part of the aesthetic enterprise.
Was that their established aim, or was that a reinterpretation of them by, you know, McClellan or something?
No, that's, I mean, in the blast put out in 1914 in the summer, Wyndham Lewis has a section called Orchestrator of the Media, or Orchestrator of Media.
Mm-hmm.
And people thought he was referring to the apparatus used in painting. Like, paints and that are, back then were called media.
Mm-hmm.
But you can tell in his poem that's in the same issue of Blast, Enemy of the Stars, that he's talking about the angelic discarnate effect of the electric environment.
Mm.
So Lewis maybe was the breakthrough guy on this, and then Pound and them, they were swept off their feet, Pound and Elliot, by Lewis.
They must not got too much traction, because when I heard Eric McLuhan giving a talk on the internet, he said if you look in any dictionary before like 1964 and you look up the word media or medium, it does not include what we consider today to be the media. It, you know, talks about, well, a medium is something that is in between, you know, two other things, you know, but it doesn't refer to the media that we think of today. So apparently, even though they were examining the media as early as 1914 or 1922, it never became established as any kind of a discipline to be studied. It never became a department in any...
Nobody knew they were doing that.
Oh.
I mean, no one got a correct view of Wyndham Lewis until Marshall started writing about him in the 50s. And then his PhD student, Sheila Watson, who became one of Canada's greatest novelists, female novelists, she investigated in detail and wrote this fantastic thesis, PhD thesis on Lewis, which was just published 3 years ago. It should have been published in 64, 65. McLuhan was lobbying to get it published. It didn't get published. And so when I sent it to the Wyndham Lewis Society in England, to Paul Edwards a year or so ago, he scanned through it. He didn't have time to read it yet, but he's going to review it, apparently. He said, man, if this was out in the mid-60s, the whole Lewis scholarship would be well advanced would have changed the whole world's understanding of Lewis. I mean, just the world just started to realize McLuhan got it from Lewis in the 90s.
Mm.
They were real artists. They were ahead of their time.
How many in the vorticist group?
I don't know, 20?
Yeah.
But the main ones are Elliot, Pound, Lewis, and the sculptor Gurdjieff Brzezinski, who I mentioned recently, had a movie made about him in the early 70s, around this time, 1971, called The Savage Messiah.
Hmm.
Try to see it.
Okay.
By Ken Russell.
Oh, cool.
But it's about the scene of clubs that Lewis designed and Gurdjieff Brzezinski hung out in,
mm-hmm.
and the aristocrats were propping up. But it all got all the vorticist movement got wiped out by World War One. I mean, Gurdjieff Brzezinski dies; he's killed in the war a year later. Lewis is
Well, no, they got established after World War One. You mean they got it wiped out in World War Two?
No. The book comes out in the summer of 1914, and it's building on a movement in London that's been going on for about a year, and there's lots of interest and money starting to come in. Remember I told the story that the one of the royal family invited Lewis to dinner, and Lewis goes and sits down at the table, but he pulls out a gun and lays it beside his plate. All right?
Wow.
He lays it on the table at his host's shock.
Yeah.
So, but the thing is, I mean, Lady Kennard was the famous woman at that time, and she had an affair with Lewis, had an affair with everybody. There's a new book on Lady Kennard. It just came out last year. Look it up. That's the scene that Lewis was the centerpiece of. But within a month, that's like July 1914, within a month, the World War One breaks out.
Oh, okay.
And Gertie Brzeska goes off to war, and he's killed by 1915. Lewis is shattered by the ridiculous, purposeless trench warfare. He's profoundly affected by the war. Pound is affected, but he doesn't fight, but he's losing all his buddies. Another guy, what's his name? T.E. Hume, H-U-L-M-E, is it?
Uh-huh.
Hume was the critic of the Vortices, influenced by Lewis and the gang, and he died in the war. And the others didn't become as famous, or they became famous in other styles of painting later. So, and Joyce was influenced by the Vortices, especially by Enemy of the Stars.
Yeah.
When he was writing Ulysses in Zurich, Switzerland.
So the blast, that was a collaborative effort? Was that the only literature that they collaborated on?
The only journal. They were all writing their own work, and Lewis was giving painting exhibitions. Pound was doing his thing as an MC, an entrepreneur of culture.
And they were all augmenting one another? They were all sort of bouncing off of each other's... They knew that they were all... exploring what the media was doing to culture and in their own way.
Yeah. I don't know if they use the term media. I mean, Lewis does, but no one knew he meant that. I mean, as McLuhan said, Lewis is the first to tackle the media environments en bloc. I mean,
yeah.
Pound, they all had a on-again, off-again relationship.
Right.
Lewis really criticized Joyce and Pound in the late 20s in his book, Time and Western Man. But see, Lewis isolated himself in the early 20s, and he started a new journal called The Tyro, and then... 5, 6, 7 years later, he started another journal by himself called The Enemy.
Mm-hmm.
And he made fun of Pound and these guys.
Yeah.
He said they didn't understand what was really going on.
Hmm.
Lewis was offering himself as a designer of cities.
Uh-huh.
He said the Cubists were ridiculous because they just did their art in little studios. They weren't looking at the new landscape, the new caveman deserts, the wasteland that was around us and the potential of it.
Yeah. Well, now, why are you using that specific word, caveman? That's how you refer to where we are now in the post-media situation as being in the caveman.
Right.
So,
I mean, McLuhan called advertising the caveman art. I say that we're Paleolithic right now. That's a retrieval in the post-information society. It's not where we're actually at, but humans are so desperate in this situation, they're retrieving caveman sensibility. Well, they're just retrieving what Lewis perceived 100 years ago, almost 100 years ago, that the electric age was a whole new, vicious new wilderness and an effect on people with incredible new superhuman potentials.
Yeah. Well, he was must have been a lonely hombre because he was the only one who really understood what he saw.
Yeah, he had a hard time doing that. Read the biography. I think it's called The Enemy.
Uh-huh.
Came out about 1980. A fantastic book. I mean, Lewis is one of the greatest minds of the 20th century, yet he is suppressed.
Mm-hmm.
Yet the guys in England who started up and got the Wyndham Lewis Society going, I'm going to visit them when I'm in London in a week and a half, they are recognizing the power of Lewis, and their mission is to topple Joyce as the greatest artist of the 20th century or greatest writer and hoik up Lewis.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe a futile gesture, but they realized this guy was just too powerful for people.
Hmm.
And he was he had many kids, many bastard children. He didn't look after his kids properly or the normal bourgeois domestic way. And one of his mistresses was coming home. I may have told this story before on these tapes. She comes home from the hospital with his new kid and has to sit outside on the street on the porch of the home while he finishes having sex with Lady Kennard.
Oh, yeah, no, I hadn't heard that story.
Yeah, he was notorious.
Yeah.
He was the original hippie anarchist. Remember what he said he was. He said he's part fascist, part communist, with a little bit of monarchism in his Marxism, but at bottom, an anarchist with a healthy passion for order.
How you remember that, I'll never know, but it's a good one.
Yeah, it's four parts. You got to realize you're that. You, most people operate that way today.
Yeah.
Quadriphenically. You know, you got fascist and communist, Marxism and monarchism. What was the next part? Maybe it's just three pairs, and then anarchism and passion for order. Did I miss one? Yeah. Fascist, communist, Marxist, monarchist, or monarchist, Marxist, and then anarchist and order.
Right.
Three pairs.
But there's no room for compassion in there.
he was very generous in a lot of his personal life with people.
Mm-hmm.
But he also had tantrums. Now, some people think that, you know, he had a bit of a brain problem, like Harold Innes did. Harold Innes was, okay, McLuhan was very impressed with what Harold Innes came up with. Well, Harold Innes got it, a big chunk of it, from Wyndham Lewis.
Mm-hmm.
Nobody knew that until a recent scholar went through the papers.
Hmm.
You know, the unpublished stuff of Harold Innes.
Right.
So you actually have this, you have McLuhan meets Innes. I don't think he becomes aware of how involved Lewis is in Innes' thinking, but McLuhan is totally influenced by Innes, by Lewis. And so he's critiquing Innes for not knowing enough about modern art. That was the one flaw that McLuhan felt that Lewis had, therefore allowing McLuhan to be more comprehensive, McLuhan felt, than Innes. But he didn't know that Innes was influenced by Lewis.
Mm-hmm.
So I went off the side there. What were we talking about just before that? So, I don't know. You said something.
Well, I don't know where else to take it. We'll probably keep getting back into the vortices movement. How much literature did they actually leave behind? Do you think McLuhan, you know, got to review everything that they left behind and incorporated into his thinking?
Yeah, what happened is, it's mainly Lewis. Lewis is the big vortex, the guy that's influencing everybody. So there were a bunch of painters, and they put on a show or two before World War One or into World War One. It was a painting movement to counter the Futurists and the Cubists. And Lewis, though, was a writer. He was the only one who probably wrote books, novels and essays and philosophical tracts and plays and everything. The Vortices movement is nowhere with. Okay, they produced The Blast One in 1914, then a year later, in the middle of World War One, in the summer of 1915, they produced Blast Two, which was another compendium of drawings and essays and poems and artwork around this group that were friends of Lewis. But what was that?
A magazine or a hardcover?
Beg your pardon?
Was this a magazine or a hardcover book?
Magazine. And Eliot was part of the second issue of Blast, and so was Pound. But Eliot wasn't in the first one, I don't think. So you have these two volumes. That's all the Vortices movement produced in literature,
mm-hmm.
or in manifestos.
Mm.
It was a manifesto, because everybody was doing manifestos once the Futurists had published their manifesto in the newspaper. in Italian newspaper. So Voices is a short-lived movement. That's why it's kind of given short shrift in art history. Like I said, it's not even the Metropolitan Museum. They have a book on the history of isms in art, and they don't have vorticism in there. Yet vorticism, a lot of novelists, post-war novelists and even recent novelists were inspired by Lewis. He's one of these guys that has a big influence in the long run.
Yeah.
And they're inspired by his writing.
I have a copy of Time and Western Man, and it's a tough read.
Yeah, yeah. It's for fully literate people.
Yeah.
But the interesting about Lewis is that he's an oral, great conversationalist. He's like Garrett Dean and like McLuhan, but fantastic conversationalist, and he would wow people just in his orations in conversation.
Mm-hmm.
And a lot of his writing, if you think of it as someone talking to you,
yeah,
then you can read it.
Maybe. I can't believe if they had to make a movie about this guy, I'll tell you.
Yeah.
No any documentaries that you know about?
No. See, he was labeled as, I mean, there's been books, occasional revivals of him or interests, like Frederick Jameson, the famous Marxist scholar of Duke University, did a book on Lewis in 79, and he calls Lewis a fascist. It's always been limited criticism. And to the average informed person, Lewis is a fascist. He supported Hitler, they think. So, I mean, that didn't help his reputation.
Right.
He makes a novel about himself that involves McLuhan, which is what he wrote after experiencing Canada in World War II, you know, as an exile.
What do you mean it involves in McLuhan?
McLuhan's a character. He meets McLuhan in 43. Lewis is inspired by McLuhan and wants to start a new journal. But then the war ends, and Lewis's wife was really nostalgic for England, so they went back to Europe. And he got rediscovered by the late 40s, and they presented his science fiction work, The Human Age, as a radio play. And then that influenced people, young intellectuals and artists in the early 50s. Mm-hmm. And Dennis Young, who I mentioned in my memo to Prince Charles in the book Fatty Communion, he was an art teacher in Nova Scotia. He told me that he, as a young student or whatever he was, intellectual in the early 50s, he was starting a magazine, and he met with Lewis to see if Lewis would contribute to it.
Mm. And you meet Lewis as a young man?
You meet
Lewis, right?
Oh, yeah, I did, yeah.
As a child?
I was 14, 1936, 37, in there. It's in the diaries. My father knew all these people.
What was your impression when you met him? Did you know there was something special about him?
Well, whenever I met Eliot or Aleister Crowley or Joyce, something, a psychic thing happened to me, some weird vision, and I list them all. It's all in the Andre Mimes and Anacreed's diary. Just look up the Lewis one. I can't remember which one. He inspired something. I got a vision. Like I wouldn't say I was psychic back then, but I had a very suggestible mind, and these people were giants, and they come into a little kid's present, I mean, the kid will kind of hallucinate on it, like a drug, right?
Yeah.
It's like my etheric body will pick up their intensities. So I always got a weird vision or an image happen, like a dream experience.
You ever check with the Evergreens to see if, like, Lewis reincarnated?
I've talked to Lewis through the Evergreens. I've had conversations with him and McLuhan and Joyce, and they discussed and argued the same old things that they argued about almost. But those are entities claiming to be Lewis and that, right?
Yeah,
I don't know if they were, but
pretty good stuff. Your wisdom is supposed to open up when you get out of the body and move on to the next level, right? So I would think they would have more advanced views.
No, that's the oversoul. The personality survives death, and so you're talking to the personality.
Oh.
For example, when Nige Lennon, one of Zappa's mistresses, heard the... she's one of the few people in the world who's heard the tape of me talking to the entity known as Frank Zappa, or claiming to be Zappa, through the Evergreens. She could hear his personality. And, you know, when I die, I won't meet Scott Norris's personality, but Scott will just be one fragment of the oversoul or the larger soul that Scott is a part of. And my oversoul will talk to each other and look at all our lives, and this present life will be just one little fragment of ourselves. but it will have its own life.
Does the personality forever become a fixture of the astral plane and stuck in its
You can relive those lives, according to the Evergreen. You could redo the Scott Norris life and change it.
Well, who's doing it when I'm not doing it, if it's still around?
Who's doing it when you're not doing it? A subset of your higher self, which contains 3,000 lives, approximately.
Okay, so I don't have to be stuck in my Scott Norris personality. I can move on, but some other part of the soul will continue to maintain the Scott Norris personality for whatever reason.
Yeah, it's like a tape. It's like a video that you have on the shelf.
Oh, yeah.
The bigger self. Whenever you want to see what you did in that life, you'll turn on the tape and see what that little focus part of yourself did.
Right.
Now, you know, if you listen to me about what goes on after you die, you probably get quite confused.
Yeah.
There ain't no peaceful Bartle transition in the Evergreen scenario.
Well, it is not in the Tibetan either. It's very serious business.
Well, this is serious business, but as the Evergreens told me, it can get quite confusing when you die. So I don't want to put a fear thing in, but just saying this will make people fearful.
Yeah.
The human personality will fear it. Yeah. But so we're talking about the vortices.
So vortices, just in the term itself, I wonder if they were thinking in terms of the electronic swirl when they came up with that word, the vortices, or if they didn't think about that at all.
Well, they might have. I mean, they might have been thinking of Edgar Allan Poe's Maelstrom.
Oh, yeah.
That McClellan always quoted.
It was. Do you think Poe was intending to comment on the electronic?
I don't think so. I mean, unconsciously, but I don't think consciously. Don't know about that.
Yeah.
I mean, he dies in 1849.
Mm.
So the telegraph is just starting.
Yeah.
But the LaRouche writes some interesting stuff on Poe. He gives great credit to Poe, like McLuhan and the Symbolist did in the 19th century.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, yeah. There's a lot of overlap of cultural heroes between McLuhan and LaRouche.
Yeah.
They look at them differently, but they...
I forgot what was it that LaRouche commented about Poe.
Oh, he said, first of all, he said he was an intelligence agent who helped Lafayette after the French Revolution and was part of a gang that was over in Europe working for the early part of the United States. It was like James Fenimore Cooper, Poe, and one other guy, some other famous guy at that time. And that there's all this intelligence level embedded in the scenario of Poe's writings.
Mm.
Like, I heard this guy on Coast to Coast last night analyzing the secret society and occult knowledge in Ian Fleming's James Bond novels.
Mm-hmm. Oh, cool.
LaRouche might see that in Poe's works.
Yeah.
I think he said Poe took on Dickens, but Dickens was, I don't know, he had to be a young Dickens.
Right.
At least, LaRouche says that Poe represented in the Cincinnati Society, the Patriot American system, who were battling the effects of Charles Dickens and those kind of liberals coming out of England.
Right.
Now, what...
Dickens gives honorable mention to the Dobbs, Mr. Dobbs, right? The Dobbs family?
Dickens does, yeah.
Yeah, but that would have been before Dobbs, your ancestors were involved in intelligence, right?
No, that's when they were. Remember, my ancestors were involved for 300 years, and the very description by Dickens of the Dobbs character is of a butler guy hanging out with the aristocrats.
Oh, so your father's father was a butler in the...
I think it's my great-grandfather.
Oh, okay.
My father was born in...
But all your fathers and great-grandfathers and so on, they were all butlers.
Yeah. And my father was born in 1882, same year as Joyce and Lewis. That's why he eventually met them. They were his generation.
Oh.
And his father would have, let's say he was 30 when he gave birth to my father, okay?
Mm-hmm.
So my grandfather would have been born in 1852. The story is written about is written in 1855, I think. So we're talking about someone who is maybe 40, 50 in 1855. So he's either the father, he's either my great, that would be, okay, my father or grandfather, would be my great-grandfather or my great-great-grandfather. See, because he could be the older Dobbs. I don't know which Dobbs Dickens is talking about. Because they all did the same function for the aristocrats. Mm-hmm. He's described by Dickens as a guy, remember the story, the article's called The Toady Tree, and he has a Hobbs, a Lobbs, a Mobbs, you know, different variation of OBBS, and one of them is Dobbs. Mm-hmm. And most of them are made up guys, but the description of Dobbs is exactly what my ancestor did. Dickens describes him as a man who, now he's a toady, right, T-O-A-D-Y, which is a put down.
No.
What we call him, someone who sucks up. In America, you call him someone who sucks up to authority, right?
Right.
So he says that Dobbs, you'd see him around the Parliament buildings at Westminster, and he'd be telling you what was going to happen in the 6 weeks. So remember, Dickens is a journalist at that time, so he's talking to people.
Mm-hmm.
In political situations. So saying Dobbs is a guy who would tell you what's going to happen in 6 weeks. But as soon as someone of stature, a lord or something, walks into the building, Dobbs would drop you and run off and hang out with the lord.
Mm.
Now, from my perspective, he had to do that because he was a butler communicating between different aristocrats, right? So he had to go hang out. But from Dickens' point of view, he was a phony who sucked up to authority.
Oh, yeah.
And was impressed with the famous politicians or the powerful people. So that's exactly what my father and grandfather and great-grandfather did.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
They were go-betweens, you know?
Right.
In a sense, in intelligence work.
Well, yeah, I guess you would learn a lot about what was going on if you were the messenger.
Yeah. So the if we actually think of it, if my father was born from a 30-year-old, that guy would be born in 1850, so that would be my grandfather. Now, my great-grandfather could be 40 in 1950, born like 1810 or something, or his father could be 70 years old. So that's great-great-grandfather. We don't know which Dobbs he's talking about.
Mm-hmm.
You know what I mean?
Yeah.
That's why I'm vague on whether it's the great-grandfather or the great-great-grandfather.
Mm-hmm.
Because both of them, the great-grandfather and the great-great-grandfather, would have done what Dickens portrays.
Mm-hmm.
Right?
Mm-hmm.
But it wouldn't be my grandfather, because he was born in 1850.
Right.
He'd only be 4 years old in 1855, four or five.
Right.
I mean, approximately four.
Well,
I mean, I can't remember.
With all this conjecture that you're doing, what?
No conjecture. What's the conjecture?
Well, there's lots of put Dobbs in on the internet. You'll find out there's lots of Dobbs. It could have been some other Dobbs grandfather. Why are you so certain that you're a great grandfather?
Because he describes him exactly the guy, what the guy does.
Oh, okay.
Remember, he knows events 6 weeks ahead of time.
Right.
How does he know that stuff? Because he knows what's being done and planned and plotted. I mean, this was the age when there was...
Well, wait a minute, Bob. I think, you know, in your line, with your family being what it is, it seems to me your family tree would be something that would be handed down as part of your inheritance.
I know what my family tree is. I don't know which Dobbs Dickens is writing about.
Oh, okay.
I didn't talk to Dickens. It's just Dobbs, and he's describing this guy who can tell you political events 6 weeks before they happen.
Yeah, but right? if Dickens places him in time and space, then you should be able to verify which man in your family tree it was.
Well, I'm saying that I looked into it, and it was either the guy who was 40 or the guy who was 70.
Well, that's a big... So Dickens is not giving you a specific time when this guy did what he did. Otherwise, you would know which one it was.
The article comes out in about 1855. And he's describing various fictional people who represent people in his social life that he doesn't like. He calls them the Toady Tree. The only one that I know is real is Dobbs.
Mm-hmm.
Right? The others might be, but in my memory, I haven't looked at the article in a long time. They seem fanciful, but or just metaphors. But actually talking about Dobbs, I mean, it's either one. It doesn't matter which one it is. But if to prove which one it is, I don't know which one Dickens was talking to.
Right.
Either the younger one. I mean, they both did, the older one and the younger one. They would have done the same thing. My father did that. I did it.
What year was Dickens talking about when he talked about this Dobbs character?
It's written, published in 1855.
Yeah.
So, I don't know if he's talking about someone he knew in the 40s.
So that was my issue. I thought he established the year that this Dobbs he was writing about, but you don't know.
Yeah, he doesn't say. He's just talking about general people around the London scene.
Yeah, okay.
Toadies. And it's published in 1855. I don't know when he wrote it or when he met these people. You know what I mean?
Right.
So we can't pin it down which one he's talking about.
Right.
But either one fits.
Your father didn't have any particular thoughts about it?
I don't recall talking about it with him too much.
Right.
Let me see. Maybe he's the one who didn't know. Mm-hmm. That's why it's so strong in my mind. I might have asked him which way. He says, I don't know.
Right.
Because you don't know who Dickens is, which Dobbs he's talking about. Because you have to realize once you're a butler, let's say you're 20.
You can place your father, your grandfather, your great-grandfather, or great-grandfather in time and space. You know what years they were alive and what years they were in their adult life. And it seems to me, based on that, if you know what year this Dobbs character that Dickens was talking about was doing his thing, you would know which man in your heritage was an adult at that time.
Okay. The great-great-grandfather was alive in his 70s. The great-grandfather was in his 40s.
Oh, I see.
They're both around in 1850,
right.
Both doing the same thing.
So it could have been either one.
Could have been either. How can you tell? Because they always did this.
Right.
They always ran around. That's what butlers did back then.
Right.
I mean, butlers on the level of the wealthy oligarchs that my grandparents worked for.
Right.
They did work on the estate, but occasionally they got to go talk to the other oligarchs, mm-hmm. part of the quote Illuminati, you know.
How far have you traced your heritage back in history? Do you know?
About 300 years.
Okay. And before that, it gets hard to tell.
Yeah, I don't know. I mean, maybe I have. I mean, I did that 60 years ago or something.
You did
a long
what?
Time ago. Yeah. I haven't pursued much of it. Over the last 50 years.
You mean looking into the family history?
Yeah.
Mm.
Okay. But it makes sense that you can't tell which one it is.
Yeah, well, I understand now. It makes sense.
Yeah, because both the 40-year-old and the 70-year-old were both running around. I would imagine it was the 40-year-old.
It was probably the rare guy that lived to be 70 back then.
No, people lived a long time back then. The average age was lower, but if you had a comfortable, pretty secure life, you could live a long time. You were taking in the famous people back then. A lot of them lived a long time.
Oh, okay.
I would say it was the 40-year-old guy, mm-hmm. because the older guy wouldn't be doing as much.
Yeah, he'd be retired.
Yeah, and I'm just assuming Dickens noticed the younger guy because he would have access to him.
Mm-hmm.
But he could have been referring to the older guy. He could have been based on what he'd heard about the older guy.
Right.
Maybe one's personality was worse than the other.
Right. Well, nevertheless, he was prominent enough for Dickens to make a comment.
You see, one could, if we could talk to Dickens through the Evergreens, he'd say, no, I wasn't even thinking of your ancestors. I was thinking about a certain kind of person. Mm-hmm. But to me, it's pretty real because it is accurate to what those butler guys did back then,
mm-hmm.
you know, what my ancestors did.
Right.
And my father thought it was referring to him. I don't know if my father had confirmation of it.
Right.
I'm assuming that. See, I found out about that when I was quite young, so
right.
It was impressed upon me that it was real, and the details were blurry.
Right.
So we're using up the whole hour here.
So 18 is in this
That's
quadrant.
That's the number for ISIS.
Yeah, ISIS now, what's his name? Worcester, David Worcester makes a lot out of ISIS and Rai. And
right.
Do you get the same ISIS vibe in the William Irwin Thompson quadrant here when you think about ISIS as what Worcester refers to as ISIS?
Maybe not exactly. I mean, most people would think Worcester's just talking about two, you know, occult or mythical figures.
Mm-hmm.
And there's lots of volumes written on that.
Mm-hmm.
But Worcester has a unique take on it. But you have to understand what his unique take is, and I don't know if Thompson would agree with that. So I'm talking about the more general Freemasonic meaning of ISIS, you know, as those secret societies give it the number 18.
Yeah.
So I see, since this is the period of
What's the story of ISIS? What's in a nutshell?
She saved and reassembled Osiris.
Oh, right.
Mythology.
He got his penis cut off and thrown in a river and something.
Yeah, he got chopped up, and then I think she put it back together, and then that got destroyed, and then she saved the penis, I think.
Mm.
So the thing is that... this is the rise of feminism and the right hemisphere.
Mm-hmm.
We're fully getting electric environment and its effects. The patriarchy's left hemisphere is getting weak. You need a new physics, a new science with Buddhism thrown into it. You know, you've heard about that kind of new science, new physics. Krzysztof Kapra, influenced by Krishnamurti.
Oh, yeah.
You know, and Taoism. So the cowgirl, the ISIS is rising. Now, also, an esoteric Worcester angle is, this is after Rai is gone. Now, Worcester says that ISIS returns with Rai to the plane of essence in January 67. But I see the after image of ISIS starting in 67.
Mm.
In other words, Rai is really weak. And
Worcester said that ISIS returns to essence with Rai?
Yeah, it's in that interview we just did.
Okay.
Now, the thing is, the after image of the android meme is more of a right hemisphere environment than a left hemisphere. It includes a simulation of left hemisphere. That's the LaRouche quadrant.
Mm-hmm.
So after image of the android meme is the rise of, you could say, Gloria Steinem, Lady Diana, Hillary Clinton. These are all after images of the ISIS effect, and they have stronger charisma. Madonna, another aspect. Women being famous and in the media in so many ways is the new effect that's predicted by the Beatles and Sgt. Pepper's Lonely Hearts Club Band went bland. Sgt. Pepper's Lonely Hearts Club Band. When they write the song, "She's Leaving Home."
Right.
That's the affluent society when girls can leave.
Yeah. The feminine is gaining momentum from the initiation of the software environment with electricity.
Right.
But here, at this point, it's crossing. It's got enough momentum that it's actually beginning to overshadow the patriarchy.
Right, and it's the after image of the chemical body, feminine version, right?
Yeah, and your idea of after image, does that sort of a direct correlation to Worcester's idea of the cobwebs of Rai?
Yeah.
So those are kind of interchangeable terms.
Right, because I even say that in Silencing the Virtually Solo Theater, I think. I talk about the cobwebs of Rai and that my chart is the after image of the android meme. And that's why I use the cobweb terms, Rai, Eloy, Tu, and Lofty, for the chart.
Oh, yeah.
Because remember, it's 1995, it's the after image of the android meme, so the cobwebs element is embedded in the chart with the terms Rai, Eloy, Tu, and Lofty. And I explain that in, I don't think it's an Up There for Andy, but in the second part, which you haven't reread lately.
Right. And in there, you attribute Rai with earth, Eloy water, Tu air, and Lofty fire.
Yeah.
But that doesn't coordinate.
No. Lofty is air. See, that's the Croker quadrant. You see air?
Yeah, but that's not how you put it in your Up the Orphic Ante. In the Up-the-Orphic Ante, you say that that Rai is earth, Ila is water, Tu is air, and Lofty is fire, and that doesn't coordinate with how you have it laid out on your chart.
Right, so that's a mistake. Maybe the reason I think of air as lofty, because lofty means you're aloft.
Mm-hmm.
It's like, I've discussed this with Worcester. It's not precise which one's which.
Right.
Because Rai, here's what happens, is that Rai creates this dimension with all its elements, earth, air, fire, and water.
Right.
But when you spell Rai as R-E-I, not R-H-Y-E-E,
mm-hmm.
it becomes earth. So the and lofty air, Tu and Eloi, fire and water.
Mm-hmm.
Doesn't matter which one's which. Unless there's some cosmic awareness readings which spell that out, you know what I mean?
Right.
But Dave was pointing this out to me. I never had it clarified completely that Rai was all the elements, but the subsets of Rai, you can't use the word R-H-Y-E-E, Rai, as a subset. So he says the spelling of the subset is R-E-I. And he just clarified that the other day. It's not on tape, but when we were talking after the session,
right.
after our tape dialogue, I brought this issue up.
Right.
So they are, it's not precise, you know what I mean? That's why it could be different in the article and different in the chart.
Because you have Bob as Earth on the chart.
Yeah, yeah.
I thought Bob would be Akasha.
I am Akasha. I'm the new Earth.
Mm.
The new being, which Dave mentions in talking about the symbols in our interview with him. He talks about the two symbols added to the 142 on the chart. And one of them, he said, was new being.
Mm-hmm.
That's Akasha to me.
Mm.
That's what, remember, this is, this chart is Connie's view, and Connie was one of the first to go into Akasha. Did you know that?
Yeah.
Yeah, you know that story.
No, well, tell the story.
When we were in Seattle in 6970, we had some personal readings with Cosmic Awareness through Dave Worcester. Doobie had died, I didn't know him. Paul Shockley wasn't the medium yet. I knew Paul. He was around then. He would become a medium in 74, 75. And Dave stopped at that point because Shockley, under Winston Turnbull's influence, sort of hijacked the awareness movement from Worcester and gave it to Paul Shockley. Turnbull always kept his distance from Servants Awareness, which was the group around Dave Worcester. Okay, so we had a couple private readings, and what awareness would talk about is that the Tridocia, T-R-I-D-O-C-E-I-A, I think that's how you spell it, the Tridocia, some traditional occult term or something, was made up of air, fire, and water. Okay?
Mm-hmm.
And so the awareness would tell you what the proportions were. You'd be a fire, water, air, or fire, air, water, or water, fire, air, or water, air, fire. You know, something like that.
Mm-hmm.
But since the return of Rai to the plane of essence, water dropped off. That's the Piscine Age, the Christian era. Water drops off. The fish drops off. And we have a new element replacing water, and that's Akasha.
Mm.
So your Tridocia, well, nobody knew what this meant. Then Carolyn had a reading, and when she asked what a Tridocia was, it wasn't air, fire, water, or some variant of that. It said it was air, fire, Akasha.
Hmm?
Everybody was kind of stunned. Here was someone who had Akasha, had actually become the new being, or, you know, had the new being in their Tridocia, the new element. The water had dropped off. It's interesting, the water dropped off, yet she's a quadruple Pisces. Very watery sign. So that was sort of impressive. I mean, nobody did much about it, you know, it just was odd. So as life unfolded over the last almost 40 years, to me it looks like if anybody's got a cash in them, Carol's got it.
Yeah. That's
the way she is.
Yeah.
And she's one of the few people who stayed in touch with Dave Worcester, of all those people around there in the 40 years ago.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, and David really admires Carolyn.
Yeah.
So what? Okay.
So B E E.
So okay. So the chart is a, is the view from Akasha, from Connie's position.
Oh, okay.
And so I represent the interface between the old being and the new being. So I give myself, since I'm connected to Carolyn, the Akashic role to represent the new energies. Though I don't know if I am an Akasha, but I see cold fusion as, and as some of the new medical technologies as Akasha-oriented.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, cold fusion would be, would be a new relationship of technology and matter, so it's kind of expressing, you know, the Akasha elements.
Mm-hmm.
Which, you know, Jack Sarfati is trying to put into a physical formula, it seems.
Right.
But it probably can't be visualized like that. So,
one element,
Rai, the actually, technically, the corrected chart would spell Rai, R-E-I, at the top, right?
Right.
But I wanted to point out Rai since nobody knew it, so I put the real Rai there, and I didn't know about the R-E-I subset.
No, okay.
So we're near an hour.
Yeah. There's two things. One is...
So I just wanted to say that starting off, as we talked about this last night, but Worcester starts off in the Thompson quadrant.
Mm-hmm.
But it turns out as you get deeper into him, you realize he covers all the quadrants.
Right.
Okay, so you were going to say?
B-E-E.
B.
Oh, okay. But it also kind of reminds me of the little insect. Is there any...
That's what I mean. I mean B-E-E, the insect.
Oh, okay.
Monsquaz on the Five Body site figured out that it refers to the B-part song Ant-Man B.
Oh.
Ant-Man B. So you've got Ant for the Roost quadrant. Man is the interval position.
Yeah.
So in the McLuhan tactile quadrant, you sort of name Man. I always considered Man the way B-part writes it. Ant-Man B. Man's in between the ant state and the bee state.
Right.
And ant is the industrial slave worker, and bee is the discarnate floating super angel.
The being.
B-E-E, the bumblebee. It's in a hive. That's our present android meme environment, right?
Oh, yeah. Plus, its buzzing is kind of like an ohm.
Yeah. And it's, when I mean present android meme, the cloned ESP part.
Mm-hmm.
Because... what is the element in the Android meme per se section, the Croker quadrant, is cloud, right?
Mm-hmm.
It's like more discarnate than the bee. It's more ethereal.
Mm-hmm.
Not as solid. And that's what the Android meme is. It's tactilely squared.
Right.
That's nothing squared.
Right. So, okay, a couple things here. One is, I'm just going to read this. We've sort of covered it, but Thompson puts on, this is from the Orphic Annie, Thompson puts on sensationalism, semiology, the printed book, and fire forged into cynical Buddhism. So what is Thompson's Munipian Buddhism, cynical Buddhism? How do you describe that?
Well, since nobody can be the archetypes, once you're living in the Android meme, the archetypes have gone, and you're inside a simulated situation, then to be a Buddhist is a put-on. To be a technological liberal, like LaRouche is a put-on version of a technological liberal.
Sure.
McLuhan's a put-on Catholic.
Right.
Croker is a put-on Marxist. They don't follow the dogma literally. You can't.
Yeah.
It's like, you know, you see a lot of New Age people, they'll offer a mishmash in their seminars of Wicca and Buddhism and Hinduism, just a grab bag. It's like a patina replay of Joseph Campbell's encyclopedia of all these different religions. How can you take these manuscript culture religions seriously? You write about them, but you're detached from it. You're in another state of being. You're actually dealing with the post-Rai returning essence when you don't need religion.
Right.
So every one of them is not your literal Catholic, Buddhist, technological humanist, or liberalist, or Marxist. They're writing books. They're starting their own movements.
Right.
they're cults in themselves.
Sure. Okay.
And cults is just having a small audience, like Terrence McKenna. You know, the
right.
fragmented audience. You got 500,000 people read your books. That's a cult. And you don't even have to run it like the old kind of cults.
But is every small audience the equivalent of every other small audience? Or if you have a very, if you're doing something potent, and your audience is tuned into what you're doing, are you having different effects within the present living matrix than some other group of numbnuts that are just getting together to, you know, talk about shoe polish
or my chart? the numbnuts discussing Bob's chart. You're saying, well, see, that's the Rumpelstiltskin thing. Everybody's in the central node. Everybody's there's not even a center, but everybody can pretend to be the center for a quark second, all right? And they're the chaos butterfly. We don't know who is the chaos butterfly. So everybody's contributing, and everybody's being canceled out at the same time.
Right.
You can't measure it. So how do we measure? We go to the White House, and we say the president runs the whole world.
Yeah.
That's our put-on response, our cynical response.
Yeah. But if you name the animals and you do it correctly, you may be hitting a chord which becomes a chaos butterfly.
Yeah, you become the tiny note. You become the strongest Rumpelstiltskin for a while.
Yeah.
Which is what I claim I am, right?
Right.
So we should end on that awesome note.
No. We got one more thing here I want to do. And that is, I have two sentences here from Silencing the Solar Theater.
Virtually Solar Theater.
One is, one sentence relates to the period from 57 to 67, and the other one relates to the period from 67 to 72. And
things are speeding up. The periods are shorter.
Right. So you can comment on these separately and then together. But after 1957, the satellite environment enabled the Tetrad manager to orchestrate software and hardware effects at will and simultaneously via the advertisement. And then for the period 67 to 72, after 67, when the satellite environment was subsumed and, quote, disappeared by holeopathic electronic autonomy, the holeopathic cliche probe merged with its medium in the style of and method of advertising, advertises, advertising. That last part's in brackets. So what do you have to say about those last two, those sentences related to the chart?
They're accurate. In other words, you're talking about after. When I say a holopathic, what do I say? Holopathic cliche probe comes after the satellite?
Well,
no, what's the word there?
Let's take them one at a time. The 67 to 72 period, after 67, when the satellite environment was subsumed and, quote, disappeared, unquote, by holopathic electronic autonomy.
Oh, okay, electronic autonomy.
A holopathic cliche probe merged with its medium. What does that mean?
Well, it's talking about the Rai effect. Rai returns to the plane of essence, and there's no separateness.
Mm-hmm.
So in light of the no separateness after 67, then that Thompson quadrant has to be merged. So I try to express that in the merger principle there between holopathic electronic autonomy and holopathic cliche probe. Is that what I say? Cliche probe?
Yep.
Yeah. So I'm just trying to show the post-Rai merger.
Why do you say that this is in the style and method of advertising, advertises, advertising?
Well, advertising was the ground and the bloodstream before 67. After that, it's like saying the after image. Advertising no longer is selling or orchestrating the consumption of other products. It's disappeared, so it's got to refer to itself.
Mm-hmm. Oh, okay. Related to what I just read and just continuing on, it says, to simulate the Rai cycle of, quote, emanation and return, unquote.
Right. Worcester talked about that in our recent interview. That's the separateness, emanation is separateness, and return to the plane of essence is what happens in the 67.
And to finish, it says, and then took off again exclamation, exclamation.
That's the cobwebs. Remember in our dialogue with Wurster, we're talking about what is man? If Rye created man, then Rye returns, is there anything left of man that was independent of his creation or survived his disappearance? And my, what I present is that technology. Well, I raised the question with Dave the other day. Is the afterimage or cobwebs of Rye the cyborgian man? Or the android meme? So that's what the chart is.
Yeah.
It's what's left over from man's evolution up to the end of Sputnik in 67.
How did Dave respond to the idea of the cyborgian man?
Well, you'd have to read the interview.
Okay. So then the very last thing it says is, this process could be considered a laundromat washing.
Okay, I just want to say, basically, Wurster remains ambivalent like me, because we don't know. He says, that's what we're exploring right now.
Right.
The answer to that question.
Okay.
So, you were saying?
It says, this process could be considered a laundromat washing the difference between a, quote, takeoff and a, quote, put on.
Right. I'm saying that Rye takes off again. That's the after image of Rye, and it's done by the android meme. And that's a replay by technology of what human spirit went through when Rye created the first happiness and left the plane of essence and created this dimension, right?
Mm-hmm.
So it takes off again. And the android meme replays that whole process as an after image, or whatever you want to call the android meme and technology taking on a life of its own.
Right.
It can pretend to take off because it's merged and actually disappeared.
Right.
So it's a fake takeoff.
Right.
And so LaRouche, McLuhan, Thompson, Croker, and Dobbs are fake takeoffs, fake Rye separateness actions, claiming to lead some improvement somewhere, or some cynicism somewhere, right?
Right.
And we don't know how real that is, because it keeps getting disappeared into homeopathic invisible levels, but they're finding out that, you know, homeopathy does have a memory. It's a living memory theater.
Mm-hmm.
Someone called me today and said the McLuhan, a certain faction of McLuhanism talked about secondary orality.
Mm-hmm.
But this person who called me says, I like the phrase electronic mnemonics. Now, mnemonics means a means of memory, remembering techniques of memory preservation. And at medieval preachers, they would look at the images in the Gothic cathedrals that would remind them how the sermon should go, right?
Right.
So you use external clues to remember what you want to say. And that's called mnemonics, M-N-E-M-O-N-I-C-S. So instead of us living in a situation of secondary orality, which was one faction's term for electronic verbality or electronic oral culture, this person telling me today said electronic mnemonics is more appropriate, and I agree. More appropriate than, because it's multi-level, multi-sensuous, not just verbal, like the term secondary orality is limited to.
Right.
So
let's contrast this state.
So the memory theater is what's going on here in the android memory.
Right. So let's contrast this 67 to 72 period with the statement from Silencing the Virtually Solar Theater and the sentence preceding it about 57 to 67, which says, after 1957, the satellite environment enabled the Tetrad manager to orchestrate software and hardware effects at will and simultaneously via the advertisement.
Right. Advertising, as McLuhan said, is a microcosm, the handicraft of Tetrad management or media ecology. The advertising seeks to know and understand and resonate off the satisfactions it wants to advertise, instill, inspire, and summarize.
Mm-hmm.
So the whole process of communication is summarized, epitomized in the ad.
Mm-hmm. Right. And then just to follow up that statement, to finish it, it says the actions of the Tetrad managers were mimed by the aforementioned 10 Orphic satellite conductors, which are various people from your chart, of the, quote, feeling analogs via musical, and then in brackets, verbal, vocal, and instrumental effects.
Yeah, that's referring to paranoia, schizophrenia, hysteria, and panic, and ecstasy. Since it's very hard in the merged condition to have any feeling, we put on those feelings.
Yeah, I don't understand that. You say it's hard to have feeling. At one place, you say that they actually we have no feeling. We're in a state. And I don't understand that. I mean, everybody has feelings, whether they're scary feelings or wonderful feelings. Everyone has feelings.
But look at the way they talk about them. They must maintain their cool in relation to them, or they must be upset with maintaining their cool and become passionate. Like Sarah Bernhardt says. Is that her name? Sarah?
Yeah.
Sarah Bernhardt?
Yeah. Are you saying we're missing some core essential feeling part of ourselves, and that the feelings that we have are like superficial reactions? Or Sandra Bernhardt.
Yeah.
Or like
Sarah Bernhardt, the famous actress in the 19th century. So I'm saying that those are chemical body things. We have new kinds of feelings, TV body feelings. And remember, Worcester talks about the womb being closed. So that's a dramatic situation over the last 40 years. So that's an abortion of the chemical body. So feelings get confused and diminished. Chemical body feelings.
Well, I remember one of the things that parents complained about was that, you know, and you would hear like this in, you know, Crosby, Stills, and Nash had that song, you know, "We're Trying to Get Back to the Garden," and Terrence McKenna said, you know, that there's this, that there's something implied, that there's something we're something implied about how we're supposed to live in this world. It's like a promise, a feeling, or something that we can't quite get to.
Right, we're numb.
Right.
We have new feelings caused by the TV body and the chip landscape. Or chip body, McLuhan said that we don't have any metaphors to describe, any way to describe these new feelings.
Well, do you think people had those feelings, they had real feelings compared to what we have today before
the
electric?
They had different feelings. They had feelings in the smaller environments.
Right.
I mean, you talk about the fascination with American Idol. That's a feeling.
Yeah.
And other people are darn fascinated by that and find it puzzling. What are those people feeling? They say they're dumbed down or something, you know. They have judgmental remarks about the way young people. Why are people instant text messaging all the time? What kind of feeling is that?
Yeah.
Why do they want a million friends on their MySpace? What feeling is that? People say they want to feel popular. Well, what does it feel like? How do you feel popular?
Right.
Basically, they want to feel huge.
Right. Well, they see the success that celebrities have, and which has a lot of charisma, has wealth. They're getting to screw the most beautiful people in the world. They're getting, you know, they have nice, you know, luxurious lives and cars, and they can go anywhere and
they
do anything.
They can explore the media.
They're talented.
Now, follow that. They can explore different media mythic stages.
Yeah.
They can explore their bodies and have ultimate mobility.
Right.
All in a state of paranoia, schizophrenia, panic, hysteria, and ecstasy.
Mm-hmm. Well, other people, I think people who have, small lives, dumb little hourly paid jobs, you know, they see that and they envy it, and so they want to have...
Yeah, that's a limited mobility if you have to go to the same place every day.
Right.
They want, and McLuhan said that women's lib was just an expression of desire for ultimate total mobility.
Mm-hmm.
Explore all the landscapes more and more every day.
Yeah.
So if you got to go sit in the same place every day, you're going to feel rather immobile.
Right.
But if you understand that you're immobile, listening to the radio or watching TV or something, that's a form of mobility, you wouldn't panic your chemical body when try to translate the chemical body into mobility. See, that's panic kinetic space that people are trying to retrieve because they feel immobilized by the super angelic state. But that's just a perceptual flaw like Othello. That's the wrong handkerchief.
Yeah.
And so they're misidentifying and finding it hard to translate the actual total mobility anybody's got today.
Mm.
They don't have to be famous or have cars or anything.
Do you think there's some primal feeling or cord, which is at our very source, that we all long to get back to but can't for some reason, and that maybe humanity, that human beings actually lived in that state at one time?
Well, that's the Rai impulse, or the Rai archetype. We separated from something,
mm-hmm.
and we yearn to get back to it. And that's on the cover of Thompson's book, The Time Falling Bodies Take the Light. It's Isis trying to bring Rai back to the original primordial feeling,
yeah.
of non-separateness.
When Rai returned to essence, we didn't return to essence with Rai then.
Our astral bodies did.
Mm.
So, and how does it get reflected in this dimension? Well, the viewer becomes a screen and watching television. So all kinds of mergings going on.
Oh, yeah. Well, that's a very potent idea right there. That's a good place to end.
Okay, good.
Thanks, Bob.
Okay, you're welcome.
So that's it for today's March the 24th, and we may be taking some time off for a couple of weeks. We'll see how that goes. So bye for now.
Yeah, I'm going to explore some of my mobility in through the chemical body.
Okay, signing off for March the 24th.